Hello. Thanks very much for coming out to Perimeter Institute tonight for this very special closing, the last presentation in the Quantum to Cosmos Ideas for the Future Festival, the 10th anniversary celebration of Perimeter Institute. My name is John Matlock, Director of External Relations and Outreach here at PI, and it's my great pleasure to welcome those of you here in our Theater of Ideas, and to those of you live, online, or on demand all around the world. In this presentation, we will be hearing from the editor of Cosmos magazine, Wilson De Silva, and the panel with some of their picks and ideas from the week of Q2C and their prognostications on the future. This will be followed by an extremely important and interesting announcement I know you'll be excited to hear about, featuring Dr. Turek from Perimeter Institute and President David Johnson, who we are happy to have here in theater from the University of Waterloo. But before we start the conversation and the announcements, let's set the mood. Let's take a moment to reflect on the world of ideas we've been exploring here at Q2C, the power of ideas. And so to begin, we have Music and Images featuring Cynthia Hebert and Jeremy Bell, and the first movements from Sonatas number 3 and 4 by Johann Sebastian Bach. Thank you. and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Bell and Cynthia Hibbert. Of course, the arts and sciences have had a long history of association in the quest to interpret the world. Leonardo da Vinci was, after all, not only the first scientist, but one of the greatest painters of the Italian Renaissance. That tradition has been nurtured here at the Perimeter Institute, where talks by some of the world's leading, almost eminent scientists appear concurrently with recitals by Yo-Yo Ma and Brian Eno, where exhibitions and talks by artists and filmmakers feature alongside jazz and cabaret at the Black Hole Bistro here inside this architecturally stunning building, sited here on the shores of a contemplative lake in Waterloo, Ontario. And so it has been with this inaugural Quantum de Cosmos Festival, a gathering that has sought to highlight this wonderful mix of the most noble of human pursuits, the quest to understand nature in all her complexity and the urge to revel in the beauty through the arts. It has been a fabulous journey these past 10 days in which I have been honored to take part as a host and moderator. Alas, tonight the journey must come to an end, and I have with me three people who will help me reflect on where it is that we have been and what we have learnt. I'll give you a quick summary. At the very end, we've got Raymond LaFlamme, who's a director of the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo and a physicist here at the Perimeter Institute. Ivan Semenyuk is a journalist in residence at the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto and a celebrated Canadian science writer. And of course, Neil Turek, who has been seen throughout the festival in so many roles. He's a director of the Perimeter Institute and a noted theorist in cosmology, particularly around the Big Bang. So let's start on this reflection. I'm going to start with you, Ray. I've heard during this festival that nobody really understands quantum mechanics.
Even after the 10 days of the festival? It's like this is nearly verbatim a quote from the famous physicist Richard Feynman. He won a Nobel Prize on his work of quantum mechanics, and despite this, he mentioned that he couldn't understand really the foundations of quantum mechanics or really the basic ideas. What he really meant is not that we don't understand the mathematics and how to manipulate the concepts together and kind of make prediction to do experiments. What he meant was that there are phenomena in quantum mechanics which are very counterintuitive, things which is very different than our day-to-day experience. And these ones are really mind-boggling. Maybe I could compare this to hundreds of years ago when people thought that the Earth was flat, and suddenly somebody came in, Galileo, and thought that it was round. It changed really the perception completely of the world in which we live. And really, what was the conception of the people? Today, we go on an airplane and you go around the Earth, and then you know that you haven't found anything which was kind of flat, then you never found the edge. We're at the same place, in some sense, in quantum mechanics. There are phenomena of having objects who can be at two places at the same time. That sounds completely crazy. It doesn't seem to make sense. But we do the experiments, which is equivalent of getting in an airplane, and the only way we can explain these experiments is to say things have to be more in one place. And this is what we have to kind of absorb to try to kind of get intuition of all of these phenomena. And the only way to get this intuition will be to get quantum technology, the extension of our fingers to go and manipulate the microscopic world.
I guess nature doesn't have to make sense. We just have to try and understand her, don't we?
Is there a difference?
Well, tell me, one of the things that got a lot of discussion during the festival was dark matter. Everyone seems to be rather excited about it, Neil. Why are they so excited, do you think?
Well, dark matter, I guess, arose in cosmology as a fudge in the
1930s. This is the time when everyone's admitting things, Alan. Yes. It's great.
It arose in the 1930s because what was observed is galaxies moving around in clusters. You could observe the speeds with which they're orbiting the cluster, and there seemed to be more mass than you could account for through the galaxies themselves. And ever since then, the evidence has grown stronger and stronger and stronger that all galaxies are surrounded by a big cloud of dark matter, and clusters of galaxies have more dark matter than any other matter. within them. I think the excitement at the festival, which some of the speakers like Katie Friis and Larry Krauss were talking about, is that there are new detections based on satellites, coming from satellites, detecting radiation from outer space, coming to us from the galaxy, which are consistent with models of the dark matter where it decays and sends gamma rays out towards, well, throughout space, but in particular towards us. And then these gamma rays would give rise to certain forms of radiation which the detectors can see. And so there's a lot of excitement that this radiation has been discovered. Whether or not it's due to dark matter is not resolved, but at least in the last few months, people are very excited that maybe we're seeing the first real signs of dark matter directly producing a signal in our detectors.
And that actually happened. Those papers were published while the festival was going, so it was we were able to talk with some of the specialists about it.
But you don't want to believe everything you read in the papers.
Telling that to a journalist. But it's why is it important? Is it? It's extraordinarily difficult to see, but it makes up a lot of the universe.
Yeah, 24% of the density of the mass density in the universe is in this stuff, which we don't know what it is. One of our best hopes for seeing it is actually in the Large Hadron Collider, which will turn on very shortly. And there are many candidate particles of dark matter that could actually be produced in the Large Hadron Collider. And if that happens, we'll see the particles spewing out of the accelerator, measure all their properties, and then be able to calculate from first principles how much of this stuff should have been left over from Big Bang. And if that agrees with how much we measure, the mass density we measure, then we'll really have understood that problem.
Ivan, physicists, they seem to have changed the world in the last 100 years. It is quite remarkable. The world that was 100 years ago is completely different.
These physicists, the first thing I want to say is I have to add something to what Ray said, because just in defense of our primitive ancestors, because while it's true that we now know the Earth is round, we've also learned this week that the universe is flat. So they might well be saying, see? in the big picture.
They were not looking far enough.
Yeah, exactly. They're telling us we needed to look farther. But that doesn't mean things aren't changing. Obviously, things are changing. And you just imagine the last 100 years. 100 years ago, the ink was barely dry on Einstein's Nobel-winning paper about the photoelectric effect, which was hinting at this idea that the universe is in some way quantized. If it were discovered today, I think we would say it's digital. There's something about the universe that's different than what we thought 100 years ago. And this also, the ink was barely dry on special relativity. This weird idea that somehow was linking matter and energy and space and time. So, 100 years ago, it seems like, well, it's more than a lifetime, but yet think about it. My grandparents, that was the time of my grandparents. They were living in that world. It's amazing to think how much those early ideas have been leveraged, and we've seen this massive transformation. We're here, we're the same, the world is here, but our concept of what's around us has completely changed. I think what's amazing for me about this kind of gathering is it demonstrates how that change happens, how you account for that velocity. And so this is the picture that I sort of had as I was actually sitting and watching the opening panel while all the physicists were talking about what keeps them up at night. I was thinking, imagine the universe. Imagine if we could all just picture the universe for a moment, whatever it is, in all its intricacies. And, astronomers, I spent a lot of time with astronomers. So astronomers are used to looking at the extremes of things, like the energy extremes. So if you look at the universe, it's full of stars. If you want to switch to higher energy ultraviolet X-rays, you get these brighter and brighter and hotter things. And you finally get to gamma rays, the most extremely energetic events. But instead of doing that, if you sort of put on, instead of, gamma ray glasses, if you put on complexity glasses, and you looked inside the universe, and what's the most complex thing? And you look through all the, little by little, the galaxies and stars would fade away. The laws that govern them are things that are simpler would disappear. And then you'd just be left, as far as we know, with this planet, with all of these little brains, which, as far as we can tell, are the most complex things in the universe. And they're buzzing around, in this building in particular, buzzing around this room. And you look, and like you peer in with this complexity telescope, like, what are they doing? And they're building something. And what they're building kind of looks like it's trying to be the picture of the whole thing. And that kind of gives me goosebumps.
That's a beautiful picture you've painted, Ivan.
That's what truly, I came away with.
Truly
that's
beautiful right. picture. Okay. And it seems extraordinary to think, Neil, that we might imagine what the universe might be like. But in those 100 years, we actually have quite a thumbnail sketch of the cosmos, don't we? And we're getting closer to understanding a lot more about it.
It's quite incredible. I mean, simply in my brief existence as a scientist, I guess in 1991, I went to a conference where John Horgan was preparing, I guess, got the idea for his book called The End of Science. It was all over. There was no hope of really understanding the cosmos. There were many different theories, and the data was all pretty rotten, and you couldn't really tell one theory from another. And suddenly, things were transformed. 92, we had the COBE satellite, mapped the whole universe. Ever since then, it's been data pouring in, very high-quality data. So we've learned things which we did not anticipate learning.
This is the Cosmic Background Explorer.
Cosmic Background Explorer. And the one thing I've learned is you cannot foresee the future. I mean, even 10 years. The most expert people in that field were saying, we will not measure the polarization of the micro background sky. It's too difficult, much too small effect. 10 years later, they were measuring it. We can't predict the future. We've stumbled on this thing called science, which is taking us in directions we cannot really foresee. And I think the one thing I got out of this festival is an incredible sense of optimism that science has a lot more to offer. And I believe this very strongly. We've just scratched the surface. What will come out of science in the future will enormously outweigh everything that's come out in the past.
Wasn't it one of our lecturers who said that, he was quoting someone else, I'm sure, but who said that it's incredibly, predictions are incredibly difficult, particularly about the future.
That's right.
Ray, Dr. Yogibera, I think.
Ray, quantum computers seem like an impossible dream to many people, but we're actually getting closer, aren't we?
We're getting there. And the reason why we don't have one today is that we're suddenly learning about controlling a part of the world of which we had absolutely no intuition before. Think about yourself getting in your car for the first time. And if you have a 16-year-old child, you'll see this happening. Suddenly they get in the car, and they go forward, and they push on the brake, and they have absolutely no intuition of how much force they have to put in there, and they end up on the windshield because they don't know exactly how to control the system. And the quantum world is a property which says that if you try to observe it, observe a quantum system, you cannot do it without perturbing it. And this is something that is very different than the world in which we live. So we have this property that if we try to look at it, we perturb it, so we try to control it. How do you control it without looking at it? And so suddenly there's this feedback loop that we have to kind of get grip to. And 10 years ago, people were saying it's impossible. It will never happen, because as soon as you perturb it, you'll kind of derail it. But there were some very clever physicists and mathematicians and computer science who came in and say, why don't we do it this way and this way and this way? And suddenly we realized this. So now on paper, we know how to do it. And we have to turn it into do it in practice.
But why is it so important? Why are so many physicists so excited about this and spending so much energy? Why do we need quantum computers? Aren't the regular computers good enough?
Well,
no.
And the answer is no.
Definitely not.
If Neil wants to simulate how the beginning of the universe has really happened, then we realize that the computers, the power that we have today is not big enough. If we want to understand materials that we have around us, if we want to do drug design, then computers that we have, they don't do the same thing, and this is not new. Like for the last 50 years, we're trying to make better and better information processing devices. And so the quantum computer is one more step in that direction. And what an interesting thing about it is that it bringing the laws of quantum mechanics to manipulate the information tells us that the way we were thinking or conceptualizing information and how to manipulate it is very fundamentally different. So the machines which were kind of idolized by using classical laws of physics, the one we've inherited from Newton and Galileo and Maxwell, have a certain power of manipulating information. And the quantum computer makes us take a quantum leap forward.
Well, there you go, quantum leap. You had to get that in, didn't you? And I should mention also that one of the things the Perimeter Institute has commissioned is The Quantum Tamers, a documentary, which actually succeeds in having not only quantum mechanics made fascinating and engaging, but have dancing girls, which I was impressed with. So you're a bit of a quantum rock star, are you?
In fact, when the first discussion about the dancers would come in my mind were classical dancers coming into this. I was a little surprised the first time when I saw the...
Do you think that film, I mean, we had actually a film festival as part of the QTC festival. Do you think that film in particular captured the essence of the excitement and the difficulty of quantum mechanics?
I think both of them. And indeed the excitement. Like the film goes, or the documentary lasts 45 minutes, but I looked at the audience because I had seen it before, and I was looking at how many eyes were kind of turning around, and none of them. So it's really gripping.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Ivan, the best way to predict the future is actually to make it yourself.
That's right. Well, if we believe Peter Diamandis, that was another exciting talk from a week ago. There are a number of things. I have to say, you know, when the XPRIZE first started, I don't know, I'm maybe the cynical journalist, oh, it's kind of a gimmick, you know. And then you see them going, just like, well, they really did it. They really actually, private invest, you know.
We should explain what the XPRIZE is.
Yes, the XPRIZE is, many people know the XPRIZE is, it was the competition about 5 years ago now. It was won. It was the first company to build a spacecraft that could go to space. You know, they defined it as 100 kilometers above the ground, and then they had to return, I think, within two weeks. That's right. But what was amazing to me is to see this being pivoted onto a whole bunch of problems that I think people never would have imagined, because it seems like such a simple, I mean, it's technically tough, but it seems like a simply stated goal. Let's just go high and then come back. But how, I mean, you know what I mean.
It's hard to do altitude.
But imagine, you know, turning that sort of spirit of competition and innovation onto healthcare, onto genomics, onto transportation and energy issues, and that's happening. Yeah. And you know, something about the way minds are rubbing up against each other and trying to do things, and you know, his point about you've got all of these people investing into trying to solve these problems just to win the prize, and the amount that they invest will actually amount to far more than the prize itself. Mm-hmm. I asked him afterwards, is there any situation or problem that you imagine could never lend itself to this kind of approach, and he couldn't think of anything right off the top, so it's amazing.
He gave a wonderful example, didn't he, of DARPA, which is a research agency in the U.S. with the Defense Department, has been spent something like $400 million trying to get a truck that will drive itself somewhere, and all they could do was something that drove 3 kilometers an hour and still needed a human being at the other end when it came to parking or something, and yet they ran this prize, which was only a few million, and all of a sudden they had the group that won spent $500,000 and the thing was driving
students
from Stanford. Yep. So isn't that remarkable? The power. I think one of the lines he it really captivated me was he said that the day before a great advance, it's a crazy idea. Thereafter, exactly. It's just it's a great advance.
And what's amazing, it's not only that, you know, something that couldn't be done suddenly could be done, but that it was done in so many different ways by so many different groups that they actually had to have a race to see who did it best. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, and you know, and just before that, no one had ever done that before. That's amazing.
Yeah. Fantastic. Neil, have all of the easy questions in physics been answered?
I think things are always look easy once they've been answered, but before they're answered, they weren't at all easy. I mean, how was Newton to predict the motion of the planets? That looked a very, very tough problem. But things fall into place when you have the concepts, the underlying concepts right. So, no, I think, again, it's the problems you can't really anticipate what's coming next.
So 2020 hindsight really is, exactly. It's easy it once you, oh, easy. Of course, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, for us today, Einstein's theory of general relativity, you know, at the time, this was such a complicated theory that it was said that only three people in the world understood it. you know, to us today, it looks simple as anything. I mean, this is a theory. You can write down the fundamental assumptions in a few lines. We compare, you know, string theory to that, and we say, God, we're in this horrendously complicated mathematical nightmare called string theory. But when we understand it clearly, it will, again, appear very simple.
Some people are quite pessimistic, though. You're not one of them. You're not one of them, aren't you?
I'm not.
Do you think that the pessimists are in a minority? It certainly felt like that during the festival, that the pessimists were in a minority, and they're actually, as you say, it's a 20/20 hindsight. Once we make whatever that fundamental breakthrough, we just don't know which door to open to find it, that things will just go, oh, there it is.
I think the pessimists are irrelevant.
There you go.
They make themselves irrelevant. So I'm very happy when I meet pessimists because I say one less person to compete with. They're out of the game.
That's true. They've given up the race.
They've given up. So it's actually amazing that people are, you know, some serious, respected scientists are going around saying this is the end of physics, or, you know, we've learned all we're going to learn. From now on, it's all going to be a mess and complicated. And I say that's fine. I had a discussion on this with a number of people about the frontier spirit. Okay, you look at the breakthroughs in science. Where did they come from? They came from people who did not, who were not, they're not for pessimists. These are people who just shoot for the stars. You know, Charles Darwin and Wallace, we heard about in that beautiful lecture by Sean Carroll. They just didn't see the obstacles. I mean, be blind to the obstacles. Go and find out how life evolved and arose, and they just went and did it. And, you know, that's the kind of spirit we want here. And I think countries and cultures without that frontier spirit are going to fall behind.
Also, and perhaps it's why that so many advances are made by younger people in their 20s, because they say, they reject their elders. Come up with my own theory. Right.
I have to say, I think what everyone's hoping for is a kind of, because there are sort of two models that we're talking about here that maybe we hope don't happen. So imagine we could go back in time 2,300 years and walk around ancient Athens, and you have all these philosophical schools, Plato and Aristotle and others would be talking about what reality is all about. And, you know, to some sense you could compare it. I mean, there are things that we know now that they couldn't have dreamed of 2,000 years ago, but some of their questions are still the same questions. Yeah. Like the most fundamental ones about existence and reality are still there. Yeah. And in some ways, they're in almost as far off in the distance.
Yeah.
But was it, so you would say, so was it worth it, the last 2,000 years, if we still don't know? And that's a silly question, because in the process of the inquiry, the voyage has taken us places we could never imagine. Like, our whole society is transformed in ways we couldn't have imagined. So it's not that we want, I think, it's not that the science, like, no one wants the Horgan scenario, which is the end of science because you can't do any more science. But I think also no one wants the scenario where there's no more science because all the questions have been answered. In fact, it's this idea that there are some questions which are still so far away in the distance
Absolutely.
That the journey is actually going to be a really long one.
Absolutely. And the right. journey isn't straight. Like, there's always some curves that are around.
Yeah.
And it is the kind of surprising curves or kind
which
of roadblock that comes in and you go around. That really makes the enterprise absolutely exciting.
Yeah.
And the real discovery, the thing that will change our conception of the world, don't come because we think it's going to be that way. Is when we kind of hit something, it tells us it cannot be the way that we've kind of anticipated. And
so you're not worried that we're going to run out of questions?
No. This is not the part which makes us stop sleeping at night.
Well, that's good. Ivan, physicists are very proud of the standard model, as it's called, of physics, but it's incredibly difficult to understand.
So my little journey into geekdom would be... you know, I'm like sitting with a copy of Scientific American, you know, reading about the standard model, trying to understand it when it sort of first came into the public eye, and trying to figure out where all these quarks were and how they all fit together. And, you know, and this beautiful thing that emerged is sort of with all the locker room smells around me and everything, trying to read this. And of course, the thing that's amazing about it is that what physicists are hoping for is that the cracks are finally appearing. I mean, in some ways, the standard model has been so successful, it's been a problem. Because, you know, like, we know that it can't be the final end of the story. Astronomers know it. I mean, it's taken a long time for this picture to emerge, but we talked about dark matter earlier. And if dark matter is real, it's not in the standard model. Therefore, there's something out there that's not being explained by this really wonderful theory.
Well, I guess part of the problem is that it has been predictive. There are some particles are predicted and actually we turned up and found it, but then some of them have been extraordinarily hard to pin down. Like you mentioned, the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
Higgs boson is one of the big targets, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's probably the single most important goal of the Large Hadron Collider will be to find the Higgs particle.
Why is it so important?
Because it explains why things can have mass. So according to relativity theory, if you have mass, you can move at various speeds, in particular zero. You can sit here in this room because you have mass. But if you haven't got mass, you have to move at the speed of light. And so we believe the Higgs field and the associated particle give all the other particles their mass. So without the Higgs field, we'd be flying around at the speed of light. We couldn't have this discussion very easily. Yeah.
Ray, we also heard that computers keep doubling in power every 2 years, but we're actually facing a brick wall. Is that true?
In fact, the Moore's law, which tells us that every 18 months we can pack twice as many transistors per unit area, tells us that very soon we'll run out of space. So about 50 years, when people started to build transistors, they were the size about a centimeter, about this size. But today they are about 30 nanometers, about 100 atoms. And if we keep on going in that direction, in about 10 to 15 years, then we'll have transistors of the size of atom, and then we cannot go smaller than that.
We also learned, Neil, that creating black holes inside the particle accelerators is nothing to worry about.
No.
Why is that?
Because if we make black holes inside accelerators, they will disappear within a few instants. I mean, that's the theoretical explanation. But in fact, the experiment's been done because cosmic rays flying through the universe do occasionally collide. And if they collided and made black holes, we would have seen them already.
So people shouldn't be worried when they see those big black holes in films. It's not that stuff. We're talking about tiny
microscopic black holes.
Yes. Yeah. Ivan, we also touched on genetics and biology, and it was particularly a wonderful piece on which you alluded to, Neil, about Wallace. Although Darwin was a giant of science, Wallace also made dramatic and important contributions.
Yeah. That was a great talk, and actually that speaks to, that teaches us something, I think. So Wallace, like Darwin, actually a little bit earlier, was in another part of the Pacific and observing other kinds of creatures, closely linked but separately adapted to different environments, and essentially came to the same conclusions as Darwin. And actually, the fact that he was going to publish prompted the publication of The Origins of Species, which is, we're about to celebrate the 150th anniversary. What that reminds us of is, and maybe journalists are guilty of this as well, there's a kind of storytelling reflex that we have to try to center a story around a key character. Mm-hmm. So we have the story around Darwin, we have a story around Galileo, a story around Einstein. But these geniuses were not working in isolation. They were in the midst of a community of ideas and thinkers, and these things were bubbling up and they were waiting to happen. And when you think of it that way, it's not surprising that Wallace and Darwin may have had the same idea around the same time. And of course, we see something like that maybe happening here at Perimeter, other places, that it's really the community effect that drives these things forward.
It's a wonderful poetic way of seeing science, isn't it? That the discoveries are there waiting for somebody to just stumble across them.
That's true.
And Alfred Russel Wallace was always very, very careful to make sure that gave Darwin credit. A wonderful quote that Sean Carroll quoted was from a letter that Russell wrote, "Never has such a complete illustration of a new branch of human knowledge been due to the labors of just one man."
Yeah. And the other cool thing about that, he's a very nice guy. And the thing that's cool about that is that, unlike, say, with Galileo, where the telescope opened up new worlds, really, evolution came about as a product of just thought. It didn't, and maybe that's why people were so suspicious of it. Of course, it kind of was a big turnaround for human identity, but, it didn't require any special tools. It just required looking at the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. And that kind of discovery is still possible.
We also heard during the festival, Ray, that artificial intelligence is way harder than we ever thought. We thought we'd have robots walking around doing our ironing our shirts, but it ain't happened, has it?
Well, maybe it's a good thing. It would be very boring if we could predict everybody in this room and know exactly where they're going to go after. In fact, indeed, it's a lot more complicated. And we heard one of the talk that happened on Friday was that trying to simulate the brain as part of a chaotic systems, and suddenly when there are stimuli that comes in, it takes it out of the chaotic stage, and then you are able to learn how to walk or do certain things. And as soon as the stimulus stops, then suddenly it goes back to this chaotic, always moving. Like when you were mentioning about Ivan a little bit early on, and these brain all is kind of moving and very fast. I was thinking about exactly about this talk of it's always moving, not only in this building, everywhere. Everybody's brain is kind of moving. And we tried to simulate this with very small computers, really. Hundreds of thousands of them put together.
He's selling us the quantum computer again.
I try.
Well, it is difficult. And what it has given is us an appreciation of the things that we take for granted. Walking, talking, writing, composing, thinking, inventing. It's way, way more complex. And, you know, that beautiful image you painted was nice.
That was one of the themes of the festival, I think, was people reflecting on technology, computers, and are they changing us as human beings? How do they affect us as human beings? It was very interesting to see some experts here coming down very strongly on the side, you know, computers are nothing like human beings. We have all kinds of qualities and capabilities which they can only dream of. And,
in fact, Cory Doctorow was making the point that, well, he threw in a line that was quite provocative, saying, our books are us, Ivan.
Right, especially the royalties, definitely. They define us.
Right.
We are. I mean, that's in some sense what seems to separate us from the rest of the animal kingdom, although it's very risky to make those divisions. But we are amassing this huge stack of knowledge, maybe someday we'll transmit it out to the stars and we'll share it with others. Maybe someday we'll be receiving, in effect, the books of other conscious beings out there in the universe. Hard to say. But even if that never happens, we're in a sense in communion with not only all of us here in the here and now, but with all of those who have come before us, that we can sort of see this gradually building thing. And that really seems to define us.
In fact, I think I recall one of the speakers saying that the body of scientific knowledge was the greatest thing humanity had ever done, ever created. So it was very poetic. String theory, Neil, has been criticized as predicting just about anything, but it's actually giving us some, it's a useful tool, isn't it?
Well, the last 10 years, I think, there has been a revolution in our understanding of space-time due to a concept called holography, which emerged from string theory. And so it's actually, even though it has not provided us with, if you like, the final theory, which will predict everything about the world, that was a, you know, wildly unrealistic hope that it would happen so quickly. Or even that it'll happen at all. But nevertheless, tools have emerged from string theory which have showed us, for example, that in some situations, space itself can be something of an illusion. You can describe something which is three-dimensional with a purely two-dimensional quantum picture. So it's given us a totally new insight which has changed our view of black holes and of the Big Bang singularity. And so these sort of theoretical, mathematical tools that have come out of string theory extremely rich and are driving the field forward.
We actually also had sessions at the pub, and one of the most popular ones was the going to Mars, where we were asking, should we go to Mars, and what are the reasons? And one of the intriguing things that arose was that planetary science has given us way more knowledge about the Earth than we thought. For example, it was studying the atmosphere of Venus and how chlorine chemistry works that made researchers look for what chlorine was doing in the atmosphere of Earth, and they found something called the ozone hole, which is somewhat important. You know, the greenhouse effect on Venus, apparently it's a runaway greenhouse effect, carbon dioxide levels. So we look at carbon dioxide levels on Earth, hello, little problem called climate change. So, you know, planetary science, and even Mars, understanding we learned about the possibility of nuclear winter, if there's a nuclear exchange, it actually freezes up the planet. from looking at the atmosphere of Mars. So it's incredibly important to understand other planets. Neil, 40,000 people came to the festival. That's not even talking about the millions out there online.
I thought you said in the audience. Wow. No.
Big hall. It would have to be a big hall.
Yeah, 40,000. It's quite spectacular. This came home to me a little when this afternoon I was looking online and I found, I just wanted to know, are there any other science festivals like this? I've never participated in one like this. And if you look online, you'll find the Cambridge Science Festival, you know, where MIT, Harvard, and I was very pleased to note that their entire participation last time around was 28,000. So here in tiny little Waterloo, we've created a science festival that is bigger, and I think the online videos are absolutely awesome. You can just see the stuff
in extraordinary
high
quality.
Definition, and I think the quality has been amazing. It's great.
We spoke last night about the future of science communication, and you know, it's amazing that while we were doing that, we may have actually been an example of the future of science communication. Because you know, there have been these wonderful festivals, New York as well, the TED Talks and so on. But of course, if you're getting them online, you're getting them after the fact. Whereas here, you know, you're actually getting it as it's happening. You know, I've been following it through the week. I'm in Toronto, you know, midweek, and I was able to actually, as though I were here, and listen in. So that was, you know, and we were trying to grapple with, you know, where is media going in the future? How is it going to communicate science? Of course, everyone remembers that Harry Potter, you know, where the newspaper opens up the newspaper, but there's the moving video. Yeah, I think in some sense we're moving in that direction. You know, the website isn't just words on a screen anymore. It's this moving picture that we're carrying around on our laptops. Maybe soon on something more flexible.
Yeah. Is your secret plan, Neil, to make physicists look like rock stars? Is that the plan?
Yes, for sure. I think the Quantum Tamers was an incredible illustration of this. Here you had these very serious, very geeky physicists who were stars of the show. And you know, I think what came across so well in that film was the deep passion that these physicists felt for the subject, and it's often hard to communicate that. So the medium is very important. So hopefully that's again be the theme of this festival. I think there's been an exceptional amount of honesty, intellectual honesty here. People telling you we don't know what we're doing. What is this quantum theory? but at the same time, you know, the extraordinary passion which we share.
And this is a teaming up of the physicists and also the executive director and the people who made this Quantum Tamers. Like the enthusiasm they had to bring it. Yeah. Because at the first sight, when they first came and talked to the people here, they thought, how are we going to bring this to life? And suddenly.
So I'd put it the following way. I mean, the discoveries of physics are incredibly powerful. And they're a set of knowledge up there. You know, we all feel small when we look at what Newton or Dirac or Einstein discovered. We feel very, very tiny. And I think having something like that is very inspiring. It inspires all of us to aim very, very high. And so things which Perimeter gets involved with, you know, film producers, Yo-Yo Ma came here and told me that thinking about space-time and quantum theory inspires his music. Wow. And we can use this as a, you know, as a means of bringing people together.
Isn't it beautiful? You brought it back to, you know, the music we began with. Yeah. You brought it back, yep. Ladies and gentlemen. You can see why this festival has been called Quantum the Cosmos. The canvas of the universe is extraordinarily large, and the task of meticulously sketching it out is a challenging one. It will take a while, and as Ray said, I'm not going to run out of questions. What's clear from listening to the many eminent speakers of this festival and from the panel here tonight is that. What drives science, as Neil said, like art, is passion. Please thank my fabulous panel. And John has some, thank you so much for attending, and John has some announcements to make.
And a special thank you as well to Wilson De Silva, editor of Cosmos Magazine, for hosting this panel, for hosting our opening panel, and for anchoring all the Science in a Pubs, which will soon be podcast through the QDCFestival.com website. Thanks to Wilson for wonderful service to the festival all week long. And now... And now we previewed a very special, very interesting announcement that we are very, very pleased to bring to you right now, live online around the world. To do so, I welcome back Neil Turok, Director of Perimeter Institute, and we welcome to the stage, the Theater of Ideas, President David Johnson from the University of Waterloo.
Okay, well, this is the end of the Quantum to Cosmos Festival, but like everything we do here, we don't rest on our laurels. This has been a huge success, but that's exactly the time to put the foot further down on the pedal. And I'm very happy to announce that we're commencing a new project, which will be an international science conference, which we hope will take place every 2 years here in Waterloo. This global gathering of researchers, entrepreneurs, and public policy decision makers will help to identify new opportunities arising in science and technology and concrete actions which can be taken in that arena to help us prepare for the great economic, social, and environmental problems and challenges which the world faces. For example, in education, energy, water, food, health, information, and global security. Perimeter Institute is delighted to be partnering with the University of Waterloo to make this exciting event happen. And with more on this, here is the University of Waterloo President, David Johnston.
Neil, thank you very much. The theme of the 10-day festival, which we have just celebrated, is ideas for the future. And what you have just indicated is a big idea. But let me give a little more preamble to that big idea. Why this idea? Why now? Why here in this place, Waterloo? Well, first of all, because of complexity, and because of the importance of clear, advanced thinking as we see our way through that complexity. There are several elements that are quite important, I think, in seeing our way through that complexity. One, of course, is innovation and innovative thinking, and we've heard much about that even in this last hour with this splendid panel. And also collaboration, the ability of people and institutions to come together to add the sum of their knowledge, 1 + 1 + 1, and adds up enormously. The pace of science is at a great rate and accelerating. The movement of technology back and forth across that spectrum from theory to experimentation to application and back again. It's a movement back and forth across that spectrum. It's not simply linear. It's two ways, and it's quite complex in occupying all of those. And finally, there's the importance of supportive public policy, both a public policy framework that encourages great science and its application, and also the influence of science and technology on the formulation of that public policy and directing that science and technology to improve the human condition. Well, collaboration and innovation are characteristics of Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics and characteristics of the University of Waterloo. In the case of the University of Waterloo, it's had quite a short history, only 50 years. In that short period of time, it has established a distinctiveness for the combination of theory and practice, the ability to bring the world of academia together with the world of work. We often say about the University of Waterloo, Waterloo works. Waterloo is the largest cooperative education university in the world, and believes that when you bring theory and practice together, very good things happen for both parts of that equation. It's also been a university that has had a passion, that word that was used in our panel, for applying ideas, for putting them to work. And as they're put to work, then to drive back into the fundamental questions to put them again and answer them a little bit differently. Perimeter Institute, well, I think it's magic. I remember being on the first site 10 years ago and on this site 7 or 8 years ago and kind of casting my mind forward. What might we expect in 5 years or 10 years, 15 years? And I have to tell you that I never anticipated that we would be celebrating what we are celebrating today in terms of the accomplishment and the power of this institute to advance our understanding of science in a very deep way and to broaden the impact of that science by making it understandable and giving it legs to reach into this community and beyond. So Perimeter, in 10 short years, I think has been very deep in discovery, has been very broad in outreach, and I think in that respect, there's a model for the world. Neil, I have to confess a little secret to you. In the very early days when Perimeter was being conceived and the idea was to have a Canadian advantage of investing in cheap science. Theoretical physics is cheap science. Essentially, you're investing in very brainy people to sit around blackboards and to speak to one another. It's not big equipment, great colliders. Is it $10 billion that the collider and you just spoke about cost as an investment? But that investment was destined to bring together people who would understand some of these very fundamental questions. And then the notion came along, but we want to popularize science. We want the ordinary person to understand this and develop the excitement. And I remember saying, that's as dumb as a sack of hammers. It's going to be hard enough to do the first job of bringing these very brainy people together. And then you're going to say, oh, by the way, you know, make that simple for ordinary folks like me so they can understand it. Well, Perimeter has done it. It's wonderful to see the impact that this institute has had in bringing science into the minds of all curious people and demonstrating its power. So we now have another big idea. And that big idea is to have the Waterloo Global Science Initiative that Neil spoke about, with a conference every 2 years that will bring together some of the finest minds in a particular area of science, and then to determine how that science can be harnessed to improve the human condition. This is an appropriate place for that kind of big idea to occur. Just down the road here, 50 meters away, is a little lake called Silver Lake. It's one of the tributaries that runs into the Grand River. And as I say, 50 meters away, there is the site of Abram Eby's gristmill that was built here in 1817, shortly after the European settlers came here. Why did he build his gristmill there? Well, there was about a 6-foot drop from Silver Lake into the stream, and there was water power, and the grain was very good. And that's how manufacturing began in this area. Grinding the grain into flour, exporting the flour, bakeries and other manufacturers that produced goods and food for people to eat. And along shortly thereafter came Seagram's Distillery, 1857, that distilled whiskey from that good water and that good grain. On this same corner today sit the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics and the Center for Innovation in Global Governance, which is designed to bring some good ideas to govern ourselves more effectively. And so we've gone from grain to brain. And in this community, we've gone from a manufacturing base, an old industrial economy, into a knowledge-based economy and a knowledge-based society. And this little corner of Southern Ontario in Canada has some remarkable things to do. I'm not sure how many people know that on this corner of Carolyn and Herb Street by Silver Lake, there are not two, but three Governor General Award buildings. This building in which we sit won a Governor General's Award. The Canadian Clay and Glass Museum, which was the legacy gift of Seagram's when it ceased distilling whiskey here, because bottles and glass were very important to that product. And then the Center for International Governance Innovation just across the street also won a third Governor General Award. I don't think there's another crossroads in Canada that has two Governor General Award buildings on the same corner. Here's one with three, and there's a fourth building being built on the corner just as we speak that may in fact be the fourth Governor General Award winning building. So this is a good place for a global science initiative. We have best wishes from the Ontario government in this venture. Let me quote from the Honorable John Molloy, who is both Minister of Research and Innovation and also Minister of Training, Colleges and Universities. Interesting that those two portfolios have been put together. In fact, the first of those portfolios, Research and Innovation, was founded by Premier McGuinty. He was the first Minister of Research and Innovation about 4 years ago, and I don't think there was a jurisdiction in the world at that time who had a Ministry of Research and Innovation whose holder was actually their first minister, that is the premier. This is the case here. It's now evolved where the individual responsible for higher education and research is also responsible for research and innovation. Minister Molloy writes, Ontario understands the value of world-class science to the future of our economy, our environment, and our society as a whole. The Waterloo Global Science Initiative will bring the world to our doorstep and shine a light on the important work of Ontario as a global thought leader, a global policy leader, and unequivocal champion for innovation as the key driver for prosperity, end of quote. And so as we look forward to this idea, we see innovation and collaboration working hand in glove. We see the whole chain of innovation from discovery, experiment, commercialization, and outreach coming together. And over the next several months, we'll be organizing the board, the advisory council, the science advisory committee. So watch for the spring of 2011 when we'll have the first of these biennial conferences, the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, with the place being Waterloo, this very innovative region of Canada, with the globe as the sphere of influence, with science as the focus of activity and initiative, taking new steps, bold new steps, and harnessing that initiative as a kind of catalyst to use science and technology to improve the human condition. It's just a great delight to be part of this new idea and to have it announced at the very last few minutes of this marvelous 10th anniversary festival of the Perimeter Institute. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, David. Well, science and technology will be vital to our future. Through wise and sustained investments, Ontario and Canada are already emerging as global knowledge leaders. Perimeter Institute looks forward to partnering with the University of Waterloo on this exciting new initiative, the Waterloo Global Science Initiative, and helping to identify the most important challenges and opportunities and which lie ahead of us, and thereby ensuring the best possible actions and decisions are taken. So now we finally do bring the Quantum to Cosmos Festival to its conclusion. In celebrating this 10th anniversary of Perimeter Institute, it's been our pleasure to provide a very wide range of stimulating discussions and lectures and other activities over the past 10 days. We've had talks and panel discussions, we've had live TV broadcasts, we've had on-site exhibits, the wonderful tent in Waterloo Town Square, pub discussions to suitably lower the tone when when we needed a bit of relaxation, a film festival showing a wonderful series of science-related films, and the launch of the Quantum Tamers documentary just after it had won a couple of international film festival prizes. So it's been extremely exciting, this festival. I can just say personally to go online and click and see some incredible lectures happening live was a totally new experience for me. And then to include questions from outside PI in real time due to people watching online. And of course, because Q2C was provided digitally, the festival will live on online in the future. And so we invite you to enjoy those presentations. I know I'll be looking back at the ones I didn't fully understand to see them again, and especially Rob Speckon's last proof of that you couldn't communicate. I need to look at that again. It can't send signals faster than the speed of light. So there's some of the presentations you simply have to watch more than once, and we invite you to enjoy them again and to share them with others. So in closing the festival, let me thank our many partners, including the Government of Canada, the Government of Ontario, TVO, our very brave presenting media partner who jumped in and put all of this on their primetime slot in the evening, and to the many sponsors you'll find on the Q2C website. I also have to offer a huge vote of thanks to Perimeter Institute's amazing staff. I think they deserve a special round of applause. I want to thank all the speakers at this festival. I think almost without exception, they showed up. And they really knocked themselves out giving wonderful lectures. Perimeter Institute researchers who have this amazing life to live here and work here and be supported by our staff. The festival producers, Tidal Entertainment, over 100 volunteers. These are incredibly special people who, with their enthusiasm and goodwill and support, made the event so enjoyable. Let's give a special round of applause to them. So we want to leave you now with some wonderful images from the past 10 days. And let's just take a look at them.